everyone, and welcome to the sixth annual lecture presented by the ANU Archives Program and the Friends of the Noel Butland Archives Centre. I'm sorry for the delay. There seemed to be a double booking with a law lecture, and we've just very quickly set up the equipment to take a podcast of tonight's lecture, so now we're ready to go. My name's Maggie Shapley. I'm the University Archivist and the head of the Noel Butland Archives Centre. The Noel Butland Archives Centre here on campus is a national collection, as befits a national university. The collection covers every state in Australia and is also strong on the Pacific, because we have the records of Australian companies such as CSR Limited and Burns Philp, and we also have the research papers of ANU academics working in the Pacific. We hold the records of many other companies, and the records of peak bodies such as the ACTU and the National Farmers Federation, and the records of many Australian unions. With over 17 kilometres of records, the Noel Butland Archives Centre collection is the largest university archives in Australia, and it's also larger than the manuscript collection held by the National Library and larger than the manuscript collection held by the Mitchell Library. I thought you'd like to know that. I'm pleased to report that next year the Noel Butland Archives Centre Endowment for Excellence Fund will allow the employment of an additional part-time archivist at the Noel Butland Archives Centre, so that's good news. At our annual lecture in past years, we've heard from professors of history at other universities, such as Stuart McIntyre and Geoffrey Blaney, but tonight we have our own Manning Clark, Professor of History, Anne Curtois. Anne has written on many aspects of Australian history: Indigenous European relations, immigration policy, Chinese in colonial Australia, journalism, television, feminism and historiography, including her prize-winning book with John Docker, Is History Fiction? Tonight her topic is Harry Potter and the Holocaust, Reflections on History and Fiction. So please join me in welcoming her to speak.
Well, thank you. Archivists, historians, Harry Potter fans, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to thank the ANU Archives Program and the Friends of the Noel Butland Archives Centre for inviting me to deliver this lecture. The lecture is in part about the importance of archives, though it will take me a while to make this clear. On my way to the archives, there are some other key issues that I want to address. And one of these is, of course, what I think the Harry Potter novels have to say about the Holocaust, or more broadly, about genocidal and totalitarian regimes and a whole range of associated issues to do with racism, the fragility of liberal democracies, and the role of the media. Another thing I want to do is to consider what the Harry Potter novels have to say about history as a particular form of knowledge, and in particular as an essential aspect of a political education. And the third is the value of both fiction and history in their different ways in helping us understand the past and sustaining an historical consciousness that at least keeps us intensely aware of the dangers facing humanity. And this will bring me finally to the archives, as they operate in the Potter novels and as they might operate for historians working in Australia today. Okay, well, why Harry Potter? Maggie Shapley's invitation came just as I'd finished the seventh and final volume in the Harry Potter series. On the weekend of the 21st and 22nd of July, I read the volume through and was struck immediately by the resonances with 20th century history, in particular the Holocaust, or more precisely the developments in Nazi Germany of the 1930s leading up to the policy of the Final Solution, the German-led genocide of European Jews and also Roma peoples. I was not, of course, the only person reading the seventh volume that weekend. This book broke all previous records for initial sales, selling at least 14 million copies around the world on its first day. And if that weekend was like the weekends when volumes 5 and 6 were released, hospitals in Britain were reporting about half their usual rate of emergency admission for child injuries. So many children were reading this novel, just as I was. So given this huge phenomenon, my interest was piqued by the idea that for emerging generations, the Harry Potter novels are part of contemporary consciousness. And so I had my topic for tonight's lecture. Now, my interest in all this is as a historian who has worked on the question and meaning of genocide, on many aspects of Australian history involving close use of the archives, and on questions of history and fiction. I'm not an expert on the Holocaust, and I don't pretend to be, nor am I, in fact, a Harry Potter specialist, of which there are a very large number, particularly in that new public sphere created by the internet. There are endless popular websites of all kinds. Some host to fan fiction, where enthusiasts write back, usually on the internet, to the novels with alternative plots and outcomes. Others compile enormous databases about the fantasy world that Rowling creates. Others are blogs discussing the novels, the characters, the plots, and other aspects. Now, for those unfamiliar with the novels, I'll say here simply, I'll just give you a very brief summary for some people, that in the seven volumes, they trace the story of Harry Potter and his friends, especially Ron and Hermione, as Harry goes through high school. High school is Hogwarts School for Wizards, whose headmaster is Professor Dumbledore, and each book covers one school year. Through the series, we learn that around the time Harry Potter was born, the evil wizard Voldemort had terrorised the wizard community. When he heard of a prophecy naming a one-year-old boy Harry, the son of his former schoolmates, James and Lily, as the one who will eventually kill him, he attempts to kill Harry instead. However, though he murders Harry's parents, the curse with which he attempts to kill Harry fails, leaving only a scar, and rebounds, severing Voldemort's soul from his body. We're told in the third volume, quote, "His power's gone, his life almost extinguished. Voldemort had fled. The terror in which the secret community of witches and wizards had lived for so long had lifted. Voldemort's followers had disbanded, and Harry Potter had become famous." End of quote. The series then outlines not only Harry's progress through school, but also Voldemort's fight to reconstruct his body, destroy Harry Potter, and again rule the wizarding world. The wizard world, however, is not a totally separate world, interacting frequently with the ordinary human world, in which humans are known as muggles. Harry, for instance, lives in the muggle world until he goes to school, and the school enrols not only wizards but also muggles like Hermione, seeking a wizard education. The Harry Potter novels then incorporate a wide range of genres to tell exciting stories of conflict, fights, battles, contests, escapes and conspiracies, along with school stories, stories about adolescence, friendships, betrayals, falling out, making up and much else. Now, there's a large academic literature growing up around the Harry Potter series from a wide variety of fields. One of the largest group of scholars keen to analyse the novels as a significant contemporary phenomenon is, unsurprisingly, the educationalists, who write about schools and schooling, and particularly the specialists in literacy, who ponder the reasons for the popularity of the novels and their possible effects on children's, especially boys', reading habits. A second major group are the literary critics, who are fascinated by the novel's form, a hybrid of school and fantasy literature, perceived as drawing on many other literary traditions as well, including fairy tale, folk tale, myth and legend, as well as incorporating classical, biblical and medieval allusions. Many commentators have noted the antecedents of the Harry Potter novels as including Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, C.S. Lewis's Narnia series, and Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea Quartet. Edith Nesbit's many novels, including The Enchanted Castle and The Phoenix and the Carpet, which developed a clash between the magical and the ordinary, are also seen as clear forerunners. And there are also clear parallels with the mythological battles between oppressive empires and those who resist in the Star Wars series. But especially important for my focus today is the series tapping into the genre of the Bildungsroman, the novel of moral formation. The series is in part about Harry Potter's political education. Important here, I think, are Jessica Mitford's writings, which Rowling has said in an interview a number of times were hugely influential on her from the age of 14 onwards, so much so that she named her daughter Jessica. And in her review of Jessica Mitford's collected letters, which appeared only last year, it emerges how much Rowling loved the Mitford sensibility. As she puts it, Decker's, that's Jessica Mitford's nickname, Decker's letters sing with the qualities that first made her so attractive to me. Incurably and instinctively rebellious, brave, adventurous, funny and irreverent, she liked nothing better than a good fight, preferably against a pompous and hypocritical target. Mitford's books celebrate the eccentricities of Mitford's upper-class English family, but they are stories of a political education as well, just as the Harry Potter series is. In her review, Rowling admires Jessica's sense of fun and extreme playfulness in both Hons and Rebels, the story of the Mitford girl's childhood, yet she also points out the many tragedies in Jessica's life. In the late 1930s, Jessica chose exile in the US over remaining in England, an England whose upper class was often anti-Semitic. Certainly members of her own family were, two of her sisters having become intimates and associates of Hitler himself. Rowling, in her review, recalls that Jessica Mitford bitterly felt that her sister Diana and her sister's husband Mosley were actively part of fascist forces that helped kill her, Jessica's husband, Esmond Romilly, who disappeared in action as a pilot in the early years of the war. Many of the themes in Jessica Mitford's writings, an implacable opposition to racism, a perpetual desire to deflate pomposity, a sense of fun and rebellion, appear, I think, in the Harry Potter series. Now, it isn't only the educationists and the literary critics who explore the Harry Potter novels for their insights relevant to their particular concerns. Other disciplines have weighed in as well: law, political science, international relations, with titles like Harry Potter and the Half-Crazed Bureaucracy and Harry Potter and International Relations, and so on. I haven't found actually many historians engaging the scholarship. One exception is Edmund Kern, a historian of witchcraft in early modern Europe and author of an essay, The Phoenix in Harry Potter, The Metaphoric Power of the Past, which I'll refer to later on. Now, it seems to me there are good reasons for this burgeoning academic interest. The first is the immense popularity of the series. If we can understand the reasons for this popularity, perhaps we will know more about our own society. As one political scientist examining the view of politics expressed in Volume 6 noted, no book released in 2005 will have more influence on what kids and adults around the world think about government than The Half-Blood Prince. It would be difficult to overstate the influence and market penetration of the Harry Potter series. But I think the second reason for the growing academic interest is intrinsic to the novels themselves, with their complex and changing storylines, large cast of characters, series of ethical and practical dilemmas, and unmistakable resonances with the modern world. There is considerable depth there, and the books are open to widely divergent interpretations. They are often criticised in Britain for being conservative and in the US for being dangerously liberal and pagan. Just as mythology functioned for the ancient Greeks as a theatre of values, characters and stories, permitting interpretation and reinterpretation, dispute and contestation about some of humanity's profoundest dilemmas, I think so these novels seem to operate in modern popular culture. So, on the basis of both their popularity and their intrinsic interest, I want to use the books to think about history and its relationship with fiction. As some of you will know, I've been pondering the history fiction issue for some time, writing with John Dogger a book called Is History Fiction, which came out 2 years ago. In that book, we argued that history is both like and unlike fiction, in that it has a double character. On the one hand, a rigorous search for truth about the past, based on a study of the traces that the past leaves behind, in documents, memories, visual images, landscapes and so on. And on the other, itself a form of narrative, which shapes accounts of the past, in particular culture-specific ways. The narrative form being not embroidery, but an integral part of the search for truth about how and why things happened the way they did. Historical writing and fiction share a great deal in their concerns, their being shaped by various generic forms, their use of character, plot, action and description. They both of necessity construct and narrate a past in some sense. However, they do so using different materials and under different constraints. History is tied to the sources, the traces I just mentioned, the archive in its broadest sense, in a way that fiction is not. History cannot imagine characters or places or times in the way that fiction can. These are often made points, and tonight I want to ponder their implications a little further through analyses of the Potter novels and their relation to history and historical practice. My next section... Hang on, excuse me. My next section is called History Dead and Alive. A troubling issue, I think, for historians is how can we understand the past from the vantage point of the present? How do we both acknowledge our present-day standpoint and at the same time fully recognise the alterity of the past, its profound otherness, its difference from the present? In my view, history that does not acknowledge the relationship of past and present is dead history. The thinker whose name is most associated with the point that all history is, in a sense, a history of the present is Benedetto Croce, especially in his 1917 essay, History and Chronicle. And in that essay, some of you might be familiar with this essay, Croce argued that only an interest in the life of the present can move one to investigate past fact. For past fact comes alive when it is unified with an interest in the present life. A past deed or event must vibrate in the soul of the historian. The historian only becomes interested in a particular historical problem when, and I quote, that problem is related to my being in the same way as the history of a bit of business in which I'm engaged, or of a love affair in which I'm indulging, or of a danger that threatens me. I examine it with the same anxiety and am troubled with the same sense of unhappiness until I have succeeded in solving it. To investigate a problem in this pressing personal way, the historian is drawn to giving a critical exposition of documents which help solve it. For Croce, the narratives and documents of the past remain empty and dead until they exist within the consciousness of the contemporary historian. Until the historian is interested and begins inquiring, such narratives and documents are mere chronicle, not history as such. And when historians are no longer interested in particular past narratives and events, they subside again back into chronicle. Croce says, the Romans and the Greeks lay in their sepulchres, until awakened at the Renaissance by the new maturity of the European spirit. The primitive forms of civilization, so gross and so barbaric, lay forgotten or but little regarded or misunderstood until that new phase of the European spirit, which was known as Romanticism or Restoration, sympathised with them, that is to say, recognised them as its own proper present interest. Thus great tracts of history, which are now chronicle for us, many documents now mute, will in their turn be traversed with new flashes of life and will speak again. So Croce suggests we write history out of the urgent concerns of the present, and this idea became increasingly influential in a context where the present itself was fraught with danger and has been taken up by many subsequent thinkers. Now, what I want to say is that I think Croce's proposition is made real in the Harry Potter novels. It seems to me the novels set up an opposition between history as a dead subject and history as necessary for life, for action. Present dangers lead us to look to the past, to understand how we reached this point and to provide clues to action in the future. In Volume 5, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, we find this. History of magic was by common consent the most boring subject ever devised by wizard kind. Professor Binns, their ghost teacher, had a wheezy, droning voice that was almost guaranteed to cause severe drowsiness within 10 minutes, 5 in warm weather. He never varied the forms of their lessons but lectured them without pausing, while they took notes or rather gazed sleepily into space. Today they suffered an hour and a half's droning on the subject of giant wars. Towards the end of Volume 7, we come to the History of Magic exam. Harry is sitting in the exam room, unable to concentrate. And this, I think, will anyone who's ever done a history exam will relate to this. He was finding it very difficult to remember names and kept confusing dates. He simply skipped question 4. in your opinion, did wand legislation contribute to or lead to better control of goblin rights of the 18th century? Thinking that he would go back to it if he had time at the end. He had a stab at question 5. How was the statute of secrecy breached in 1749, and what measures were introduced to prevent a recurrence? But had a nagging suspicion that he'd missed several important points. He looked ahead for a question he could definitely answer, and his eyes alighted on number 10. Describe the circumstances that led to the formation of the International Confederation of Wizards, and explain why the warlocks of Liechtenstein refused to join. I know this, Harry thought, though his brain felt torpid and slack. Now, in contrast to this irrelevant dead history, the logic of the story through the Potter novels is always that one can only go forward by going back, by understanding one's enemy and his or her formation. The characters in these novels learn in different ways to recognise how the present is a consequence of past events. As Edmund Kern points out, each volume not only takes the story forward, but also takes it back into the past as well. And you've got a double movement, really, for every volume. Harry and his friends become historical detectives, motivated by urgent present needs. And this is especially true, I think, of Volume 6, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, a large part of which concerns Harry being taken back into the past by the headmaster, Dumbledore, through the mechanism of the Pensieve, a shallow stone basin that stores thoughts and memories that take the form of a silvery substance, which, when you put your face into it, gives you access to those memories. So these memories are Dumbledore's and others are other people's memories that he's collected over time. On one occasion, Harry asks, "Where are we going, sir?" "For a trip down Bob Ogden's memory lane," said Dumbledore. "He was employed by the Department of Magical Law Enforcement." And then, sounding just like any modern practitioner of oral history, he goes on. "He died some time ago, but not before I'd tracked him down and persuaded him to confide these recollections to me." So Harry is taken back to the past of his father's generation and to the generation before that, a past that involves dangers of various pressing kinds. The past is no longer a chronicle, but an essential aspect of the present. And the novel is, in fact, one long history lesson. Not the droning about giant wars of Professor Binns, but the exciting, though disturbing, experience of being hurtled back into the past itself. Through accessing Dumbledore's memories and other memories he's collected, Harry learns about Voldemort's past, what made him the fiend that he is, seen as necessary preparation for their final battle. He learns about Voldemort's parents, the poverty-stricken but pure-blood wizard mother, and the rich muggle father, the father's desertion, the mother's death, the childhood in a Dickensian orphanage and then at Hogwarts School, where he descends into the dark arts and begins a campaign for power. But Harry also learns some quite morally complex lessons when he sees these memories. He sees that at school his father was not always right and was at times a bully, and that his revered godfather, Sirius, was also not as perfect as he would have wished. Harry doesn't only gain insight into the past from the Pensieve, he also learns from his friend Hermione, who gains her information and understanding from books, especially Bathilda Bagshot's The History of Magic, a school textbook. In Volume 7, we find that Bagshot is an incredible magical historian. Hermione's book learning is often important at crucial danger points in the novels. Hermione, however, is no mere uncritical reader of these texts, for as well as learning from them, she also sees their limitations, especially those of another book, Hogwarts, A History. In Volume 3, when she knows details about the forthcoming inter-school tournament that none of the others do, she tells her friends. It's all in Hogwarts, A History, though of course that book's not entirely reliable. A Revised History of Hogwarts would be more accurate title, or A Highly Biased and Selective History of Hogwarts, which glosses over the nasty aspects of the school. So when Ron asks her what she means, she replies, "House elves, not once in over 1,000 pages does Hogwarts, A History mention that we are all colluding in the oppression of 100 slaves. This is the elves. Hermione returns to this theme in Volume 7 when she comments that wizarding history often skates over what the wizards have done to other magical races, by which she means goblins, elves and so on. She also tells Ron that goblins have got good reason to dislike wizards. They've been treated brutally in the past. Okay, I come to the Holocaust. The attempts by Voldemort and his followers to take over the wizarding world grow with each volume, reaching a crescendo in volume 7, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. Voldemort from early on seems to be some kind of Hitler or Stalin or perhaps Pol Pot or Idi Amin figure, a sort of mixture of all of those really, a figure seeking absolute power. What made me think of the Holocaust more specifically when I read Volume 7 are several key themes. The importance of racism and the exploitation and exclusion of people on the basis of race. The creation of an atmosphere of terror so great that for many the best option is to flee. And the move of Voldemort's forces from paramilitary private forces to the centre of government. Indeed, it's not so much the Holocaust itself that it brings to mind, as I said at the beginning, the period really leading up to it, the habits of mind and the political situation that helped make it possible. These conditions for the emergence of fascism were investigated by Hannah Arendt in her path-breaking book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, and remain a point of fascination for contemporary history and sociology. So, let's look at these themes and the way they develop. The theme of race and racism permeates nearly all the novels, with an ongoing struggle within the wizard world between the desire for racial purity by some and the acceptance and welcoming of both wizards and muggle and people of mixed race by others. In Volume 2, Dumbledore tells the ineffective minister, Cornelius Fudge, that he places too much importance on the so-called purity of blood. "You fail to notice," he says, "it matters not what someone is born, but what they grow up to be." Reminding me of no one so much as Martin Luther King's "I Have a Dream" speech, in which he looked forward to the day when people would be judged not by the colour of their skin, but by the content of their character. Against Dumbledore are the racists like the Malfoy family, who hate muggles, whom they dehumanise as mudbloods and desire the supremacy of the purebloods. In Volume 2, Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, Draco Malfoy calls Hermione a filthy little mudblood. The question of purity, though, is complicated by the fact that Voldemort himself is a half-blood, as is Harry. Like Darth Vader, he is perhaps rejecting a past he now considers shameful and impure, and it's a complicated question. While the parallels are not, of course, exact, the emphasis on race purity surely calls to mind Nazi ideology of the 1930s and 40s, alongside other racialised regimes through history. Then there is the depiction of the rise of a terrorist organisation which eventually seizes power. The government, the Ministry of Magic, for a long time refuses to believe there is any danger from Voldemort and directs its attention against those who say there is, including the headmaster, Dumbledore and Harry. In Volume 5, the Ministry attempts to expel Harry from the school and strips Dumbledore of his various government positions, including headmaster of Hogwarts. The sinister and authoritarian Dolores Umbridge is appointed High Inquisitor at the school. She brings in limitations on freedom of speech and movement, alters the curriculum to diminish dissent and produce obedient subjects, and tortures Harry when he insists on Voldemort's return. That Voldemort has returned. Volume 6 sees a government that does acknowledge Voldemort's rise but tackles the issue ineffectively, despite its draconian security measures. Now, all this reaches a peak in Volume 7, the final volume, when the forces of evil triumph and Harry and his friends must destroy the dictator Voldemort. The image of takeover by evil forces could be drawn from any one of a number of places, but to my mind, the clearest analogy is with Hitler and the Nazi regime in Germany of the 30s and 40s, and I just want to evoke some of this for you. In Volume 7, Remus Lupin, a former teacher and a long-term opponent of Voldemort, announces very early in the novel, "The Ministry has fallen. Scrimgeour is dead." That's the next minister. "They are coming." Voldemort has put in place a puppet government under the well-named Pious Thickness, leaving himself free to extend his power. The troops who call to mind Hitler's brown shirts are the Death Eaters who set out to break up the Order of the Phoenix, which once spearheaded the opposition to them. When carrying out activities as Death Eaters, they wear black hooded robes and masks which conceal their faces. Where the Death Eaters had been an extra military force, now they are government troops suggesting various military forces such as the SS. The Death Eaters are wizards and witches under the leadership and direction of Voldemort, who seek not only to purify the greater wizarding world of Muggleborns, they also attempt to create a new order through the Ministry of Magic. "What you've got to realise, Harry," says Lupin, "is that the Death Eaters have got the full might of the Ministry on their side now. They've got the power to perform brutal spells without fear of identification or arrest. They take over the Daily Prophet, the leading but often unreliable newspaper, whose very name has sinister millenarial overtones reminiscent of Nazi claims to the future." "But surely people realise what's going on," Hermione asks, and she's then told the coup has been smooth and virtually silent. The official version of Scrimgeour's murder is that he resigned. Now, although many people have deduced there has been a coup, given the dramatic change in ministry policy, they merely whisper it. They daren't confide in each other, not knowing whom to trust. They are scared to speak out in case their suspicions are true and their families are targeted. The ministry starts to move against the Muggleborns, those who are born as ordinary humans but have become part of the wizard world through the meritocratic effects of education and also through intermarriage. Hermione reads from the Daily Prophet. "Muggleborn Register," she read aloud. "The Ministry of Magic is undertaking a survey of so-called Muggleborns, the best to understand how they came to possess magical secrets. Recent research undertaken by the Department of Mysteries reveals that magic can only be passed from person to person when wizards reproduce. Where no proven wizarding ancestry exists, therefore, the so-called Muggleborn is likely to have obtained magical power by theft or force. The Ministry is determined to root out all such usurpers of magical power and to this end has issued an invitation to every so-called Muggleborn to present themselves for interview by the newly appointed Muggleborn Registration Commission." When Ron says, "People won't let this happen," Lupin replies, "It is happening. Muggleborns are being rounded up as we speak." He goes on, "Unless you can prove that you have at least one close wizarding relative, you are now deemed to have obtained your magical power illegally and must suffer the punishment." The Ministry produces propaganda pamphlets headed "Mudbloods and the Dangers They Pose to a Peaceful Pureblood Society." Furthermore, to attend the school, Hogwarts students must henceforth be given blood status, meaning they have proven to the Ministry they are of wizard descent before they are allowed to attend. And Hermione, the smartest student at Hogwarts, is Muggle-born and under the new rules would be excluded. It isn't only the Muggle-born who are under threat, but those who sympathise with and support them. The puppet Prime Minister, Thickness, declares, "If you ask me, the blood traitors are as bad as the mudbloods." One of the most evil characters in the series, Dolores Umbridge, having taken over the school as headmistress in Volume 5, is now Senior Under-Secretary to the Minister and Head of the Muggle-born Registration Commission. The Muggleborns are brought into the Ministry for questioning. In disguise, Harry sees them. The dark passage outside the courtrooms was packed with tall, black hooded figures, their faces completely hidden, their ragged breathing the only sound in the place. The petrified Muggleborns brought in for questioning sat huddled and shivering on hard wooden benches. Most of them were hiding their faces in their hands. Some were accompanied by families, others sat alone. And then, abruptly and shockingly, amid the frozen silence, one of the dungeon doors on the left of the corridor was flung open and screams echoed out of it. "No, no, I'm half-blood, I tell you. My father was a wizard, he was. Look him up. Archie Alderton, he's a well-known broomstick designer. Look him up, I tell you. Get your hands off me, get your hands off." Still in disguise, Harry then takes action, telling a character named Mrs. Cattermole, "Go home, grab your children and get out. Get out of the country if you've got to. Disguise yourselves and run. You've seen how it is. You won't get anything like a fair hearing here." He then tells the rest of the Muggleborns waiting to be interrogated, "You should all go home and go into hiding with your families. Go abroad if you can. Just get well away from the Ministry." We can think here of the Austrian Gerda Lerner, who later became a leading feminist historian in the US, pleading with her family in late 1930s Vienna, she urging them to leave, and they reluctant and unsure as catastrophe approached, and, of course, of innumerable others. Some Muggleborns do flee. Hermione sends her Muggle parents off, perhaps in slightly clichéd fashion, to Australia, having modified their memories so that they believe that that's their life's ambition. Australia here functions as it has in English literature since at least Dickens' Great Expectations, as a place of sanctuary and perhaps renewal. In general, Muggles remain ignorant of the source, though, of their suffering, because they sort of get the backlash of a lot of this, as they continue to sustain heavy casualties. However, we do continue to hear truly inspirational stories of wizards and witches risking their own safety to protect Muggle friends and neighbours, often without the Muggles' knowledge. Interestingly, while the wizard-Muggle distinction dominates, there's also another dimension, and this is the distinction between the wizards and their elves who work for them in conditions close to slavery. In earlier novels, Hermione's support for elves' rights has been somewhat mocked, including by her friends, and she's portrayed as perhaps a little too zealous, somewhat inappropriate in her fervour. But in this final volume, we come to see that perhaps she has a point. Harry, Hermione and Ron realise that the purebloods and the racists cannot recognise that the elves have their own magic, their own forms of knowledge, and can do things the wizards can't. Even sympathetic characters are guilty of being unable to see the elves as beings with feelings as acute as their own. The elves can be read perhaps as slaves, perhaps as indentured labourers, perhaps as colonised indigenous peoples. Harry's political and historical education now reaches a culminating point, so that now he can sympathise with a variety of marginalised peoples. One of the targets in the series is the press, or more broadly, the media. In Volume 4, The Goblet of Fire, we meet Rita Skeeter, a reporter who first builds up Harry as a hero and then tears him down with inaccurate and biased reporting. In that novel and the next one, there are many instances of the Orwellian ministry attempting to make the press print government propaganda. Interestingly, there's something of a breakthrough when an interview with Harry is published in the Quibbler, a popular tabloid, since the more official newspapers like the ill-named Daily Prophet will not tell the truth. In the seventh novel, Harry, Ron and Hermione are on the run, living in a tent and protecting themselves with various defensive spells and charms. Hermione reads A History of Magic by the light of her wand. They have few sources of information, but Ron has a small wooden wireless through which he can tune in to a fugitive radio station, the only program that tells the news like it really is. Quote, all the others are on you-know-whose side and are following the ministry line, but this one, you wait till you hear it, it's great. Only they can't do it every night. They have to keep changing locations in case they're raided, and you need a password to tune in. Eventually they find the program called Potter Watch, and here they hear about the murders of Muggleborns, goblins, and the murder of the celebrated historian Bathilda Bagshot. They also hear about some resistance developing at the school, calls to mind the history of clandestine radio stations used by the French Resistance and others in the Second World War and in many other contexts. I'll stop this narration here. I hope I've indicated enough to indicate how powerful are these allegorical images of the dangers of oppressive or eminently authoritarian or totalitarian regimes, with their censorship, suppression of opposition, turning media into pro-government propaganda, use of torture, hunting down of suspects, forcing people to flee, and the beginnings of resistance. They allude to many political scenarios, Nazi Germany, I think, prominently among them. We see in Rowling's fiction a kind of heterotemporality with all sorts of histories acting on and in the present. Okay, my next section is called History and Fiction. Now, there have been major debates over how to write the history of the Holocaust and the history around it, for it is such a major, complex and dreadful event that the issue arises, do historians have the skills to narrate and analyse such events? In his book, Constructing the Holocaust, Dan Stone argues that historians have reacted to the difficult task of representing the Holocaust by domesticating it. Far from allowing it to change the way we think, as it ought to have done, historians have simply fitted it into existing frameworks of knowledge. In an effort to bring the chaos of the Holocaust under some kind of control, they've produced very straightforward conventional narrative histories and avoided innovation. Surely, he reflects, the Holocaust in making us aware of general problems of representation that are normally passed by with ease asks us to change the way we write history. It reminds us of the importance of foregrounding the gap between the texts historians write and the past itself, and challenges conventional, realistic modes of narration. Excuse me. The Holocaust, Stone contends, is characterised by a disruptive excess that cannot be assimilated into the cognitive rational framework of conventional historical writing. Such a framework cannot explain the extreme character of the Nazi period, cannot comprehend the very excess, the rush of energy, which permitted normal societal structures to become organs of mass murder. The horror of the Holocaust, as he puts it, can invade the present, challenging humanity to understand and know itself at its most ordinary and its most extreme. Now, Stone, of course, is advocating not fiction, but a new kind of history. A kind of history that, like the Harry Potter series, does not simply evoke the Holocaust as something that happened in the past, but also suggests that it remains an ever-present possibility, presaging the future emergence of terrorist regimes from within liberal democracies. The hope is to write a kind of history that, through its portrayal of people and events, makes us reflect on the present. And this finally brings me to the archives. If historians need to use their imaginations to find new ways to narrate Holocaust history, and indeed the history of extreme events more generally, they also have their distinctive tools of trade, and these are the historical sources they use, especially the archives. It is historians' task to ask new questions of the past and to look in new places for the answers, and here the archive comes into its own. The question of the archive and how to read it has been sharpened by the problem of Holocaust denialism. And in this way, the Holocaust has become something of a litmus test for current practice and thinking about the problem of truth. Now, again, the Harry Potter novels offer some insights, I would suggest, into the archive. Harry's direct accessing of memories through the pensieve is, one could suggest, just a magical means of doing what historians do every day. Accessing memory either through an oral history interview or through a written archive. The pensieve is simply a magical archive. It is not only memories that Harry and his friends must access to learn what they need to know to defeat the forces of evil. They make use of old letters, photographs, tombstone inscriptions, old newspapers and diaries, every trace they can. When Harry finds in Volume 7 a letter from his mother, he thinks, "The letter was an incredible treasure, proof that Lily Potter had lived, really lived, that her warm hand had once moved across this parchment, tracing ink into these letters, these words, words about him, Harry, her son." Photographs are very important, and not only because the images in them move. Harry looks at a picture of Dumbledore with his family when a small boy, seeking to understand Dumbledore's family history. Later he sees a photograph of an original letter written by Dumbledore with Dumbledore's familiar, thin, slanting writing. Sometimes information comes from old newspapers in a manner that would do the Australian Dictionary of Biography proud for its tracing of genealogy through scraps of information. Hermione tells Harry near the end of Volume 6, "I was going through the rest of the old prophets and there was a tiny announcement about Eileen Prince marrying a man called Tobias Snape, and then later an announcement saying she'd given birth," and so it goes on. Diaries also figure as sources of information. In Volume 2, Harry discovers a diary with blank pages, finding that if he writes in it, its former owner writes back. The former owner is Tom Riddle, in fact Voldemort as a boy, though Harry doesn't yet know this, and we might think that Riddle's name itself allegorises the enigma of the past. Through writing in the diary and reading Riddle's answers, Harry is taken back into the past to Tom Riddle's school days. What a metaphor this is, I think, for the ways in which historians read the archives. They are as if blank until we open them, with some kind of question in our minds. Until we want to know something, they are just there. But if we ask questions, they might yield answers. The archive lives when we use it. So to conclude, what can historians learn from novels and novelists learn from history? There was some conflict over this a year or so ago when historians Mark McKenna and Inga Clendinnen questioned Kate Grenville's claim in relation to her very successful novel about one part of the Australian frontier, that is the Secret River, her claim that novelists could explore things historians couldn't, the intimate, the emotional, the personal. I won't revisit that debate in detail here except to say that Grenville, and I think perhaps also her critics, set up an unnecessary dichotomy. I would want to emphasise the exchange between different forms of knowledge within the broad sphere of public and collective memory. Grenville not only has a very restricted sense of modern historical practice, but also underestimates how much fiction learns from and interacts with our contemporary historical consciousness itself, drawing on historical work. And for the historians, the challenge is to contribute to this broad public sphere within which historical consciousness is created, through asking the archives new questions and finding new ways to communicate their findings. I hope we're able to do so in J.K. Rowling's spirit of connecting the present to the past in telling relevant and complex ways. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Now, we have got a little bit of time before we have some wine and cheese, so I don't want you to take too long. We do have a little bit of time for questions, so if anybody has something they'd like to ask Anne, please raise your hand. Up the back here.
Oh, thank you. That's very good. The postmodernists have suggested that it's all rather a cliché. Excellent analysis, of course. But what do we do with fiction and history to prevent, to prevent these such horrors in the future?
I don't think any single thing can do that, but I suppose the point I was making near the end about a critical and aware public sphere that I think both novels and history contribute to, that lively, critical, aware sense of what has happened, what is happening, what could happen, that's part of at least what you might do. There's a lot of other things, of course, political structures and all those things, but I think that a healthy public sphere is probably my first answer to that question.
Thank you very much for that, Anne. Most enjoyable. Perhaps one further answer to what was just asked is the role of the Harry Potter novels themselves in, if you like, conveying a message to their readers, children of various ages, so that an educator might say, well, the Harry Potter novels will have a salutary effect in alerting people to the implications of certain kinds of political behaviour or certain sort of types of regimes. That may be a bit optimistic, I don't know. What I myself am wondering is whether those who, kids reading the Potter novels, as it were, get the benefit of what she's doing, of all that you've drawn out for us, about her recourse to history and historical sources and so forth, whether they will get through to that beyond all the negativity of the history lessons, the history of magic, which of course is pretty sort of the kind of packed view on the part of children about their history lessons often.
Yeah.
The exam that you mentioned I think it's in Volume 5, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what do you think of that?
Well, the problem is people do read them very, very differently. Like I alluded to that very briefly. But, I mean, some people, quite a lot of people in cultural studies see these as very conservative novels. I mean, I've read them as quite the opposite, but that's quite a common reading. And a lot of feminist criticism, and I haven't gone into this issue very much, sees them as very, you know, anti-feminist, conventional boy hero, blah, blah, blah. I don't agree with that either. So how children read them, and especially if you've got, I mean, they've sold 325 million copies. It's a lot of people. They're going to all read them very, very differently. I think what I've picked up is that a lot of the education people, academics who discuss the Harry Potter novels sort of are very aware of exactly this point, that, you know, you can use them really to investigate certain issues in the classroom because they're so open to different readings. They're very complex, but so I'm really just giving what I think my reading. I felt a bit weird at one point. Here I'm saying talking about wizards. It felt a bit weird. I mean, just, and I don't want to sort of answer it by talking about Rowling herself, but at one point, one interview I did read, she sort of said, well, yes, my politics are left wing. However, people will read the books in very different ways. She's not presenting the books as her politics exactly. So
Let me just conclude by saying, after your lecture, I feel very disappointed that my grandson in last year of primary school in Victoria has only been asked, compare volume one with the first film, what are the differences? That's a bit ordinary after what you've told me today.
I guess it's kind of along the same lines, but I just wondered what you thought about the possibility that they're sort of falling through the gaps in terms of significance, because any adult reader would, of course, draw out all these obvious clues, but they would kind of know them already, whereas children might read them and never see anything at all. And I found it really interesting that you compared it initially to the Narnia series, because as a child I loved those books, and as an adult I went back to them and was completely horrified that the evil race was called Colour Me. And the significance of the books may really not be so great, because the message might not reach the children and has already reached the adults.
I would imagine that actually a lot of children, they might read, like the bit I was reading out about, the Muggle registry and all of that, they might have no knowledge that that's got any relation to anything that's ever happened, so they'll read that. But I suppose you can think, well, having read it, when they do learn other things, they can put things together. But you're right, you can... They're open to quite different... They are really are open to different readings, and that's I think, part of the reason is... when I offered to do this lecture, I had no idea there was so much scholarship about this. I really did. I had no idea. And I can start, having got into it, I can start to see why, because there's, the complexity of, the questions of reception and reading come into it very much, yep.
Given that you mentioned that Rowling's politics is leftist, do you think there's a subtle message in her overall books 1-7 that give us a message now about our general apathy, about the comfortable lifestyles we have and the acceptance that because we're doing well financially as middle class and we're just motoring along economically beautifully, that she's sending a subtle message that we need to be wary of that comfort and look for those moments when things change without us even noticing they're changing.
I would agree with that, yeah. I mean, I think she's saying more than one thing, but I actually do agree with that there's something that's about being... there's a real desire for an alert public and a real critique of a public that takes no notice or doesn't want to think or, just looks after itself. So I would agree with that, yeah. Yeah.
We have a question down here. We might make this the last one, and if people could ask Anne things over wine later, that would be fine.
I was impressed by your message about novelists and historians. One historian of World War II, or one novelist of World War II that I've always been very impressed with is Herman Wouk, Winds of War and War and Remembrance guy. But I've often found his history is more accurate than the actual historians who write about the war.
Yeah, I couldn't comment on that exactly, but I agree. Our understandings of the Second World War are from a very wide mixture of sources, and you have to, in a sense, be ready to listen to any of them and also critical of any of them, and it's not necessarily that... the histories that are going to have the best account. I think that's true.
I'd just like to call on Mark Wilson, who's the president of the Friends, to come up.
I have very little to say other than on behalf of the Friends of the Noel Butland Archives, who are always looking for members and supporters or anyone else who wants to help, I'd really just like to thank Anne for the profoundly thoughtful and thought-provoking talk embracing history of magic and the magic of history. And we have a very, very small gift for you. There is something in it.